In Syria, a whole town erased by war. Today, Tuesday, November 5th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A correspondent in Damascus calls the war in Syria a war on society.
Mothers said to us, you know, my children haven't seen a piece of bread in 9 months. We have been eating grass and leaves.
Also, how Syria's rebels are recruiting through social media, and later a soccer player in England is knocked out, but then keeps playing, reigniting the debate over concussions in sports.
3 times he stopped. 3 times those medical professionals had an opportunity to say no, to tell him to get off the field.
Plus, preparing to communicate with extraterrestrials.
If we ever receive a message, it will be traveling at light speed and coming from a long distance away, so it will be telling us about their past.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at stopdiabetesnow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. As if war weren't bad enough for Syrians to live through, they now have polio to deal with, too. The World Health Organization has confirmed an outbreak of the infectious disease among babies and toddlers in northeastern Syria. Now the Syrian government says it's working with international organizations to mount a polio vaccination campaign in the middle of its civil war. It says the goal is to immunize all children in Syria, even those living in rebel-held areas. The BBC's Lise Doucette is one of the few international reporters in Damascus. She says of all the tragedies she's seen in Syria, the outbreak of polio is among the most heartbreaking.
You hear the hopes of Syrians, especially the youngest Syrians, that someday this war will end, that for the children with polio, the impact of the war will be with them for the rest of their lives. Polio is incurable. There has no treatment. And there is a very, very deep concern that there are still areas which the government cannot reach with the help of the United Nations to vaccinate urgently. Possibly 500,000 Syrian children are not being vaccinated. And polio moves very, very fast. And it moves with people and with millions of displaced in Syria, some 6,000 crossing borders every day. The risks of infection, not just in Syria, but across the region, are very, very high.
Of course, this is happening while the war rages. Is there even the mental space for these parents you met to be thinking about a disease?
As one mother said to me, there is nothing more important to a mother than her child and the health of her child. And health officials, government health officials, the United Nations is deeply worried about this. All Syrians should be, everyone around the world should be, because the future of your children is the future of this country. Now, we did speak to some UN officials who say there have been talks about using the Syrian Arab Red Crescent Society, the volunteers there, who have been crossing lines, are working in both areas controlled by the opposition and the government. So there's some hope that perhaps they can begin get to some of those areas. But I have to say, you know, I've been around in the suburbs of Damascus. We watched the partial evacuation of Muadamiya this week, and people came out in terrible condition. And we know that both sides in this war are still not putting humanitarian concerns above the war, above politics, and using siege, the denial, the blocking of aid and food as a weapon of war. The opposition is using it in the north. The government is using it around Damascus. And so the appeal has gone out from Syrians, from the international community, for what they call a vaccination ceasefire, for a humanitarian ceasefire. Let the people not suffer for this punishing war.
So they're talking about a vaccination ceasefire. But for those moments where the interested parties have gotten into these areas under siege to deliver medicine or food, how do the negotiations happen when the sides are so polarized? I mean, is there any room there for duplicating that kind of intervention?
Well, as you know, Marco, in many conflicts in the world, and you've seen some of them yourselves, that the people do talk. They talk between relatives. They talk between representatives. They talk, you know, behind closed doors, behind the glare of the media. But in some parts of the country, there's no talking going on at all, which is why they're using intermediaries like the Syrian Arab Red Crescent Society. But take the case of Muadamiya. There was said to have been a temporary ceasefire arranged between the government and the opposition, in which the fighters would be allowed to go free. But we saw them being separated, women, children on one side, the young men on the other, and they were taken away. And We've been trying to confirm where those men are. The opposition activists we speak to inside Mwadamia say anywhere from 230 to 500 young men are now in a military detention center. It's impossible to confirm that because that is in the realm of intelligence and security here. But it's clear some men were taken away. We saw them boarding those buses, and we've heard that not all of them turned up at the shelter where the women and children are now. So the opposition says a trust was broken. You made a deal and you didn't honor it. And that, of course, means that there will be even less trust the next time they try to arrange deal in another besieged suburb. But it's very, very hard with the wars of our time, particularly the war in Syria. We're not talking about trenches. The war is on society. The war, I saw one neighborhood on the edge of Damascus. We're not talking in the northern region, the edge of Damascus, which looked like an earthquake zone, where we were shown by one of the Syrian soldiers there that the Syrian troops were on one side. The opposition fighters were on the other. They fought house to house, street to street. There is nothing left there. And that is Damascus in the 21st century.
Lise, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Marco.
The BBC's Lise Doucette speaking with us from Damascus. As the war in Syria drags on, opposition rebel groups are facing the relentless need to recruit new fighters. And one disturbing way they do that is by posting images of dead fighters on social media. They present these dead fighters as martyrs and heroes, and they tell followers they can be heroes too. The Washington Post's Joby Warwick has written about this. Describe, first of all, Joby, these social media posts for us.
Well, it's definitely an unusual way to attract followers, but this is a very serious effort. What happens is after someone dies on the battlefield, there's a sense that the rebels need to present him as a martyr, which is a very big deal. And you do that not with just a nice casual photo of the guy who is living, but an actual portrait of the man in death. And typically these are rebels that are posed in very natural, sometimes smiling, sometimes grinning poses to suggest that they've gone to their reward in the afterlife.
So grinning, do they die with a smile on their face? Or are they actually posing their faces into smiles?
The secrets of how they manipulate corpses are exposed here, but there is a sense that they are being manipulated. It's fairly easy to do. You can show someone appearing to be grinning, even if in some cases they have grievous injuries. Sometimes parts of their bodies are missing, but they manage to pose the face in a way that it looks like they're actually smiling or grinning even.
Joby, you talk about these dead men. Are there any female martyrs?
Have not seen any female martyrs, but interestingly, they come from all across the spectrum in terms of foreign countries. There are Europeans, there are many North Africans, people from across the region, not just Syrians. In fact, it seems to be that the ones that are most likely to be posed in this way are foreign jihadis who come to Syria to fight.
You've written in your reporting that Jabhat al-Nusra, the Islamist faction linked to al-Qaeda in Syria, uses Twitter and Facebook in the same way as corporations and government agencies in the U.S. Explain that.
We've seen for a very long time that jihadist groups, al-Qaeda and others, like to use the internet. But in the case of these Syrian groups, it's quite sophisticated. They've got sort of daily tweets, daily updates. They've got followers, sometimes tens or even hundreds of thousands of followers for some individuals. And they use the Twitter to counter negative messages, to present themselves as good guys, as people who are charitable, who try to help the communities where they live, and try to oppose this concept that they're al-Qaeda-like or rebels. And, of course, our government, the United States, thinks they are indeed terrorists.
Are they also using it as kind of a propaganda machine to raise money?
Absolutely. In fact, there have been some very innovative uses of Twitter and other social media networks to raise money, not just by appealing or sending out some random appeals to people to send them cash, but also to put up pieces of merchandise, a car, a diamond necklace, even a hotel package, and put those up. They try to hold online auctions using Twitter. They get money to come in. They post an account where the cash can be deposited, and they can raise millions of dollars who that means.
Back to plan A, though, for this campaign, basically recruitment for new rebels. Is that working? I mean, a picture of a dead body, does that make you really want to go and fight?
Yeah, one would not in this country or in a Western context, surely, but for the Islamist, there is this belief that that dying in the cause of jihad is essentially the highest thing you can do, the most supreme sacrifice a person can make. And so there is this sense that if you become a martyr, then you go immediately into paradise, your body doesn't decay. It's, and all these rewards are associated with that. And so by showing dead corpses in these very peaceful and sometimes very happy positions or expressions, it does sort of reinforce the idea that if you come here, if you die as a martyr, this is a great thing you're doing for, you know, for the cause, for Islam, for Allah, and it has an appeal.
How does Twitter feel about this? I mean, what is the protocol at Twitter when it comes to such gruesome images on its site?
It's a very interesting dilemma for Twitter and some of these other social media sites, because they are well aware that they're being used to present these kinds of messages. Occasionally, they'll try to block a site or block an account that's being used by a known terrorist organization. But the truth is, there's way too many of these to try to monitor or to try to stop every one. And so, you know, despite the criticism, these groups would just say, you know, this is really not something we can control.
Joby Warwick with The Washington Post, thanks for talking with us.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Social media is used for all kinds of causes, of course. Right now, something called Movember is trending on Twitter. Maybe you've heard of Movember, like November with an M. It's a campaign to raise awareness about prostate cancer and other men's health issues. Thousands of men take part by growing a mustache during the month of November, hence all the selfies posted to social media sites to document the growth of facial hair. Okay, but that doesn't explain why Movember is trending heavily in Indonesia. You see, Indonesia doesn't have a Movember campaign. So we asked the world's social media producer, Tori Stark, to get to the bottom of Movember madness in Indonesia. Tori, what'd you find out?
Well, Marco, people are tweeting with the hashtag Movember simply because there's so many people tweeting in Indonesia itself. Jakarta is the most active city on Twitter in the entire world.
Wow.
Actually, 2% of the entire worldwide tweets are coming from the city of Jakarta.
That's incredible. So I know Indonesia is a very populous country, but why is Twitter so popular there?
Indonesia has the fourth largest population in the world, and under half of the population in Jakarta are under the age of 30. So people are really using it in their daily use, whether to get around, to communicate with their friends, or for more social campaigns. People are actually making a living using social media. There's a new class of citizen called buzzers on Twitter specifically, and they're being paid on social media to send tweets by advertisers.
Wow, how much do they get for each tweet they send?
A buzzer is paid starting at $21 per tweet, but it can be anywhere up to $50 per tweet.
Do you think Twitter knows about these people in Indonesia kind of squatting on their business model?
Yeah, it's actually interesting with Twitter's IPO coming up, how Twitter is going to position themselves. Twitter in the U.S. has used celebrity endorsements in the past, but nothing so widespread as in Indonesia. And it's actually interesting with a lot of Twitter's upcoming changes with promoted tweets that advertisers can directly promote their own tweets and not go through celebrities or high-profile Twitter users.
What are the companies that are actually using buzzers?
One of the things that I've seen a lot is Nestle. Nestle Indonesia uses a lot of Twitter buzzers. And a lot of the companies that are using these buzzers ask the buzzers to tweet between the hours of 7 and 10 a.m. or 4 to 8 p.m., which is traffic time for Jakarta. So a lot of people that are stuck in traffic jams in Jakarta are scrolling through their Twitter feeds and seeing these influential tweets.
As the traffic jams increase in volume, the tweets go up, I guess.
That's right.
We should note, too, that Movember is not using buzzers, right?
No, it's interesting. I talked to someone that identifies influential tweeters for buzzing campaigns, and she said that she's only noticed it this year in particular, and it's become a pretty organic movement. Not a lot of people are actually doing the campaign, but people are so clued into what's going on around the world that they're using the hashtag.
The world's social media producer, Tori Starr, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Marco.
Still ahead on The World, how to say hound dog in Swahili on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association. November is Diabetes Awareness Month. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com and by Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Toronto Mayor Rob Ford finally admitted it. He smoked crack cocaine. Ford had been hounded by the allegation for months, ever since a video surfaced in July that appeared to show him smoking a crack pipe. This afternoon, Ford held a press conference to apologize, but he made it clear he has no intention to resign before Toronto's next mayoral election in October 2014.
I want the people of this great city to decide whether they want Rob Ford to be their mayor. Again, I sincerely apologize.
Toronto Star reporter Robin Doolittle has been on the story from the start. I spoke with her earlier today, right after Ford made his admission he smoked crack.
I was completely shocked. We had no idea this was coming. The mayor does not speak to media ever, really, and we were all waiting outside his office, and he emerged from the elevator, and he turned to everybody, and he said, ask me the question that you asked me last May being when the Star published its story about the mayor appearing to smoke crack cocaine in this video, and someone said, do you smoke crack cocaine? And he said, yes, I smoke crack cocaine. The air fell out of the room. Everyone just almost started shaking. It was so unexpected.
What was the second question?
When was the last time you did this? What's in the video? And he kind of turned it around on the reporters because he didn't want to appear that he was lying. When he's asked about it, he always says, I'm not an addict. And reporters always point out, well, that doesn't mean that you haven't smoked it before. But he's really been very aggressive with the media. He's called my paper pathological liars. He's called us maggots. He accused the media of maybe not asking him the right questions all along. He again apologized for his behavior, and he said he wants to move forward, and he's indicated that he doesn't plan on stepping aside.
He qualified that he smoked this while on a kind of a drunken binge, right?
Right, yeah. He said, you know, because we're trying to then ask him specifics, were you smoking crack in the video? And he said something to the effect of, well, I don't really know. It might have been a year ago. Like, who knows what I'm doing in my, quote, drunken stupors.
Clearly, he was ready to talk. Do you know what prompted this admission?
No, we're all trying to figure that out. I can just say from my personal opinion, I don't know this, just watching him, it seemed like he just decided that this wasn't going to go away, and he had to get this off his chest, I guess, for lack of a better expression.
Will there be charges? I mean, smoking crack is a crime in Canada, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated, though. So there's a video of him appearing to smoke crack cocaine. He certainly looks like he's holding a crack pipe, but you can't know what he is smoking in that pipe. And I think admitting to a smoking crack, it's not necessarily that you're going to charge him after that. He's not been caught red-handed with it. But at this point, I mean, a possession charge, there's so much more at stake. Like, he is running the fourth largest city in North America. It's one of the largest governments in Canada. It's a $10 billion budget. A possession charge is not going to get him out of office.
Robin, Toronto is a great world-class city, but it's gotten some nasty international attention for this. What's the Mayor Ford crack business done to Toronto and the people who live there?
Well, I think you sort of nailed it on the head. Everyone in Toronto really loves this city, and we're all very proud of it. And when you're listening to the public reaction on Twitter, that's what everyone's concerned about, is what does the world think of us that we have this crack scandal brewing here and that he's still the mayor? So I guess on behalf of my city, I will say Toronto is a lovely, lovely place to visit.
Robin Doolittle with the Toronto Star. She helped break the story on Mayor Ford. Thanks very much, Robin. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
From our northern border to our southern one now, if you've ever been to the U.S.-Mexico border, you know how hot it can get down there and how temperatures in the desert can change quickly from blazing daytime heat to freezing nights. Those are the life-threatening conditions facing migrants who try to cross into the U.S. illegally. Some die trying. Others actually call 911 when they're in trouble. Jude Joffe Block of the Fronteras Public Radio Collaboration sent us this report from Arizona about how dispatchers respond to those calls from the desert.
This is 911. Do you have an emergency?
The callers tend to sound desperate, usually speaking Spanish, often with bad phone reception. This man, who said his name was Yoel, called for help on a June day when temperatures hit triple digits. We're dying, he says. We need help. On the other end of the line, a 911 dispatcher at the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office in Arizona. Next, they'll loop in a Border Patrol agent. The agencies can collaborate to find migrants like Yoel. But the remoteness of the area and the older phones that migrants tend to carry can make it hard to trace their location very precisely. Yoel can't identify nearby landmarks. I just see low hills made of rock, he says. Michelle Bush, a 911 dispatcher for Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, says that's typical.
North, south, east, west, they're like, have no clue. All I see is mountains.
Bush works in Phoenix, more than 115 miles from the border. But this summer, she and her fellow 911 dispatchers helped rescue more than 30 people in a remote corner of the county. It's a growing phenomenon as more migrants take longer, riskier routes to avoid detection. In Arizona, many are trying to make their way to an interstate, more than 80 miles from the border. Smugglers might drive them for portions of the way, but they walk long stretches to avoid Border Patrol checkpoints. Sometimes they're abandoned or get lost along the way.
I don't tend to ask, are you an illegal or were you dropped there? You know, my job is to find out where they are.
Rescue missions can take hours and cost thousands. Time is of the essence, though, since once migrants call for help, they're often already suffering from dehydration or heat stroke. In the winter, hypothermia.
¿Está respirando? ¿Está todavía desmayado?
That same day in June, when the migrant named Yoel called for help, Bush got a call from another group. These migrants were already sick and fainting in the heat. She gave a pep talk to one young man named Heliberto. Bush says, listen to me. I know you think you can't do it, that you're in bad shape. But she tells them she won't let them down. She's sending a helicopter. She coaches them to make a fire so the helicopter can spot them. Do they know where we are? Heliberto asks. Do you swear to me? Bush gives her word. I thank you with all my heart, he says. But when the helicopter got to the area, it located a different group of lost border crossers and rescued them first. One of the men called back desperate, convinced he was going to die.
He wanted to give me numbers, addresses, his wife's name, his kids. And I'm like, no, that's not what I do. I'm not going to do that because you're going to survive.
Bush does check to see what happens at the end of a rescue after she's no longer on the phone. That particular rescue took over 7 hours and ultimately wound up locating over a dozen migrants.
They did make it to Border Patrol. They got medical help. And from there, you know, I'm sure that they were taken back. But they all made it, thankfully.
Not everyone does. The Maricopa County Sheriff's Office recovered 17 bodies in the same area this summer. More than 160 bodies were discovered statewide in the past year. For The World, I'm Jude Joffe Block, Phoenix.
Jude's story is part of our Global Nation coverage. You can find more at PRI.org. And be sure to join the conversation. You can tweet us at PRI Global Nation. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, a German artist takes a sideways glance at his adopted city, Brussels, and he concludes that when it comes to solving problems, there are solutions, and then there are Belgian solutions.
I'm kind of the guide for Belgian solutions. I always say, like, look here, do you see this cable hanging out there? Isn't that weird? Or do you see how the whole city is taped together?
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at stopdiabetesnow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. We've been hearing a lot about football injuries, but lots of contact sports are facing pressure for dealing with them properly, especially head injuries. Now, every coach in this country knows exactly what's supposed to happen when a player appears to have suffered a concussion. When in doubt, sit the player out. That's the mantra. This past weekend, though, in England, a glaring example of what not to do. A star soccer player, Tottenham Hotspur goalkeeper Hugo Lloris, took a blow to the head and blacked out. When he came to, still dazed, his coach let him play on. And now that coach is taking a lot of flack for that. Taylor Twellman knows this topic well. The former New England Revolution striker had to retire from soccer after a severe head injury. I asked him what he made of the call to let Lloris play on.
Other than barbaric, I thought it was ridiculous. First and foremost, when you really watch the replay, he's knocked out. He's unconscious. The medical professionals on the field, the athletic trainers, even the teammates, Michael Dawson for one, all talked and walked Lloris to the sideline. And three times he stopped. Three times those medical professionals had an opportunity to say no, to tell him to get off the field. But it's also not the first time. Lukaku himself was knocked out in an Everton game before this. He should have came out. Robert Huth from Stoke City was knocked out. Flamini from Arsenal. This just continuously happens in England and in Europe. And I think everyone needs to realize that it's not just a United States problem, concussions, and an American football problem. It's a life problem in general.
Right. It's not the first time for Lloris and head injuries. In 2012, he knocked a Spanish striker out while punching a ball away from the goal. His manager at the time was critical of the refs for not stopping the match, saying the health of a player is more important than anything else. So on one hand, health is important. In the most recent event, it's play on. Do you find that inconsistency a lot in the world of soccer?
Yes, I do. It's a huge problem right now, and particularly in the United States. Obviously, the NFL has garnered a lot of the attention and the NHL, but the numbers show us over the last 5 to 6 years, soccer has the same amount of concussions that football and hockey do due to the amount of kids, boys and girls, playing the sport. And that doesn't change. That's not just a United States problem. That's not just an England problem. It's a world of soccer problem. There are head injuries. And I think FIFA and every league around the world needs to address this as soon as possible. This is, if Lloris sustains a second hit after that one, we're talking second impact syndrome, which often turns to be fatal. This isn't a career question. This is a life question. It's just disappointing that in 2013, we still have to figure out what's going on in the field of play.
What about soccer and head injuries in the U.S.? I mean, you dealt with a serious head injury. You've kept playing afterwards. But in the U.S., is it better or worse than in other parts of the world as far as soccer is concerned?
Are we more aware? Are we more open to it? Are we more actually concerned about it? There's no doubt in my mind. And I'm not saying we're perfect on how to deal with the recognition and rehabilitation of traumatic brain injuries, but we are definitely trying to figure out ways to make the athletes get off the field quicker. And it's not, I'm not talking the professional level. I'm talking about the amateur level in trying to lead examples, because there's too often times that the recognition is a little slow, and then all of a sudden it becomes a second and third hit, and then you end up like me, where the rest of my life is completely changed now because of that decision to stay in the game.
There is another match on Thursday that Lloris might play in if he does go on the field. What do you think that says about the way soccer treats concussions, even after a high-profile blackout during a high-profile game?
I think it's obviously their medical professionals, their doctors, are not fully committed to understanding the traumatic brain injury, because if he was fully knocked out, there is strong medical research that shows at the minimum 10 days of no physical activity.
ESPN soccer analyst Taylor Twellman, also the founder of the Think Taylor Foundation that raises awareness about traumatic brain injuries. Thank you very much, Taylor.
Thank you.
A quick note now on a more positive development in the world of soccer we want to tell you about. It's about Cyprus, a small Mediterranean island that's been divided between a Greek side and a Turkish side for almost 4 decades. That's also meant that soccer teams and players from the two sides don't mix. Well, today, soccer's governing body, FIFA, announced a breakthrough. It said it brokered a deal to unite the soccer federations of the two sides. The Cyprus Turkish Football Association will become a member of the Cyprus Football Association, based on the Greek side. The details still need to be hashed out, but the hope is that eventually Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots would compete in the same league like they once did, and that players from both communities would be eligible to represent Cyprus in international tournaments. For now, FIFA said in a statement, the tentative deal is an excellent example of how soccer can build bridges and bring people together after a long period of conflict. There's a new warning this week about the likely impact of climate change on the world's food supply. It's part of a draft report from the UN's climate science panel, the IPCC. The leaked draft says climate change is likely to cut global crop yields over the next few decades, even as demand for food keeps growing fast, creating a potentially dangerous gap. David Lobel of Stanford's Center on Food Security and the Environment is one of the authors. He says the overall trends are clear, but that scientists are still trying to get a fix on where the changes might be the most dramatic.
The effects of climate change are already evident in a lot of regions of the world, and that's something that we've really seen come up in the literature over the last 5 years. And then if we continue unabated out to scenarios of very high levels of global warming, it presents a very large challenge out 50 or more years to food security.
So do scientists agree on how food production will be affected by climate change?
Well, the whole process of the IPCC is to try to assess the consensus of the literature. And only when there's lots of agreement for lots of different approaches do we really say that there is strong consensus. And in the topic of food production and food security, there is still a lot of uncertainty in various aspects, which is to say we don't think the case is completely closed.
I mean, we've had big climate-related problems in recent years in North America, but we're also seeing in places around the world, like wine grapes being grown in places like the UK where that's never happened. So what are the frontiers, if you will, of the shifting agricultural picture?
Well, when we look at, for example, the studies of what's happened already, and like you say, you see situations in Northern Europe where you see crops being grown that would never have been grown before. That is a pretty clear example locally of things that are likely to be strongly influenced by climate change. If you look at tropical areas and looked at our understanding of how sensitive those yields are of crops like wheat or corn or other things, lots of different studies have concluded that there's significant impacts. But this is an example of where we still don't have very good understanding of the adaptations that are actually going on. And we don't have a very good understanding, even where we do see adaptations, of how effective they are. You know, I think Australia is a case where you've seen pretty good work on what's actually happening in response to the shifts. For example, the big drought that they had. For example, the peanut industry relocating to another part of Australia. And so this, I think you're hitting on a clear challenge we have right now, is it's very hard to say anything very concrete about where adaptation is insufficient to keep up with the impacts.
David, where have you been working specifically on this issue? Like, what part of the world?
So my own work actually has lately been a lot in the U.S., also in places like India and sub-Saharan Africa. And from a climate perspective, you know, the reason the U.S. is interesting is it's a very high productive system, which means that really agriculture is up against what the climatic potential is. And what that means is we actually see quite large sensitivities in the U.S. system. And so because it's such a large producer and because it plays a major role in setting global prices of food, that's one area that we focused recently.
I mean, the U.S. is a high productivity country, and that entails a huge economy of scale. Is that a disadvantage if there's a crisis? I mean, Africa, for example, could kind of turn on a dime and adapt pretty quickly, I'd think.
On the face of it, you're correct that there's lots more potential to adopt existing things in a place like Africa. On the other hand, the innovation systems in places like the U.S. and the ability to rapidly adopt things is much higher. And so it is an interesting question in terms of which areas are capable of adapting the most or changing the quickest, but it's not an obvious answer.
You seem pretty certain, David, that the changes are going to continue. Are they locked in, or do we have any wiggle room if we can somehow change course on the ways people respond to the challenge of climate change?
Well, my impression is that the next 20 or 30 years, we are committed to a certain rate of climate change. Now, we don't know exactly how fast it'll be, but it's very likely that warming will continue to happen over the next few decades. When you look out past 2050, say, then it really becomes an issue that we're not locked in, but it's a matter of what decisions we make going forward about how much we emit.
David Lobel, the director of the Center on Food Security and the Environment at Stanford University. He's also co-author of the new draft UN report on the likely impacts of climate change. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, Nashville plays host to the Country Music Awards. Country music is about as American as it gets, right? It's now the most popular genre in the U.S. In Africa, not so much. But there is one guy who's working on that. Valerie Hamilton has our story from Kenya.
The band's just getting started at the Reminisce nightclub. Everyone's in checked shirts and cowboy hats, drinking beer out of long-neck bottles.
6 days on the Rooter said I'm gonna make it home tonight. I've got my 10-4 gear on a Joe German ride.
We could be at any honky-tonk in Tennessee, but the thatched roof overhead and the elephants on the beer labels give it away. We're in Nairobi, Kenya, and on stage is Kenya's king of country music.
6 days on the Rooter said I'm gonna make it home tonight.
Sir Elvis is his stage name, but his real name is Elvis Otieno, and he may be the most successful country musician in Kenya. That's partly because Kenya doesn't have country musicians.
Every time we hit the stage, it's always like a shock.
You see, Kenya loves American country music, old school country from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Recorded in Nashville, not Nairobi.
Most of the people here listen to country music. It really has a huge fan base. People love Charlie Pride and Jim Reeves, Dolly Parton, Kenny Rogers, Don Williams, Skeeter Davis. But I think they couldn't imagine that a Kenyan could do country music.
Elvis was born in 1977, the same year the King died.
My dad named me after Elvis Presley. My mom was a great fan of Elvis Presley. So when he died, I think it was a great blow. I guess they decided to name Elvis.
That name may just have sealed his destiny.
When I was a kid and Karamus put me to bay, put a picture of Stonewall Jackson above my head, then daddy came in to kiss his little man. Gin in his brain, Bible in his hands, he talked about honor and things you should know. In his stagger ladles went at the door.
Elvis may be African, but his early life is straight out of an American country song. He was born in a whistle-stop town on western Kenya's railroad line. He's the son of a Pentecostal preacher who played gospel music on the guitar. I am not making this up.
When I look back at my life and I'm like, okay, I think that's really country. Yeah.
So what do you do with good old boys like me? I can stand in a soft set of means and a live old tree. Those Williams boys, they still mean a lot to me, like Tennessee.
The family left Kenya for Norway when Elvis was 7, which explains his Scandinavian accent. That's where he got serious about country music. He played in a country band, he started listening to new country, and as a student, he visited the U.S. and took in his first country concert, Shania Twain.
It was a dream come true.
Put on my blue sweat shoes and I bought in a plane. Turned down in the land of the Delta Blues. In the middle of the pouring rain.
When he moved back home to Kenya 10 years ago, he decided to take his music to the next level. Just one problem, Kenya doesn't really have a next level, and especially not for country music.
I had to start from really, really, really from nearly nothing. Music industry in Kenya, it's still really very young. People love to listen to it, but there has never been a serious country star.
Do you really feel the way I feel?
Elvis is trying to change that, building a following in Kenya gig by gig. And he hopes someday to take his music back to the source.
So the ghost of Elvis, Union Avenue, followed him up.
And it should come as no surprise that there's something this Kenyan musician has in common with every other aspiring country star in the world. He wants to play Nashville.
They just hovered round to bear us a pretty little.
For the world, I'm Valerie Hamilton, Nairobi.
Down in the jungle room, when I was walking in Memphis, I was walking with my feet and feet all of beer. Walking in Memphis, dear, and I feel the way I feel.
Pinch me. I think I was just dreaming. You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. And by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The odds of being alone in this universe just got smaller. Scientists now say there are billions of potentially habitable Earth-sized planets in our galaxy. That got us thinking about the possibility of actually making contact with some galactic neighbors, like in the film Contact.
I mean, it's highly unlikely that they would understand what they were looking at. People need to understand the science.
The people are in very good hands, Dr. Arroway. We'll take it from here.
Not so far-fetched for Jill Tarter. She directs SETI, that is, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute.
When SETI got started as a NASA project, protocol was official at that point, and it specified who would talk with the executive branch of the government. But since 1993, we've been raising the money to do this work privately. And so the protocol that we have doesn't officially involve anybody in the government. And it is simply make sure that you're right, send out a scientific paper on the discovery, send out an IAU telegram that alerts all of the world's observatories, and then hold a press conference to tell the world, because that information is the property of humankind.
Have you ever had any close calls?
Yes, we've had a couple of very, very memorable false positives.
Like when?
The last time actually was 1998. Our equipment was compromised by a lightning strike, and so we got a signal clearly technological in its nature, and it took us the better part of a day to finally figure out that it wasn't coming from a star that we'd been tracking. It was, in fact, coming from a spacecraft that's in orbit around the sun called SOHO.
There have been many attempts to communicate with potential intelligent life out there. Voyager 1 and 2 had those gold-plated records aboard with sounds and images chosen by NASA to represent Earth. What are your thoughts about these attempts to communicate between Earth and who knows what out there?
I sometimes say we lied through our teeth.
In what way?
Well, because everybody is beautiful. There's no poverty, there's no war, no disease, no pollution. Looking forward to potentially having another opportunity to create a portrait of Earth and who we are and how we understand our place in the cosmos. Potentially, that will be possible with a spacecraft called New Horizons, now on its way to Pluto. And we are circulating a petition right now asking NASA to permit a portrait of Earth that is actually crowdsourced. We'd like to get the world involved, and we think we can, given the social media globally now.
Does this discovery that there may be 40 billion habitable Earth-type planets out there, does it give you more hope that there is life out there? I mean, it must.
Life as we know it is a planetary phenomenon. So knowing that there are lots of planets out there is a good thing in terms of upping the odds for there being life somewhere else.
I gather your lab is always prepared for the celebration in case it does happen.
At the observatory, in the refrigerator, there's a bottle of champagne that there's a big label on it that says SETI Success Plan. And we certainly intend to celebrate the detection of a signal.
Astronomer Jill Tarter, who directs SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute in Mountain View, California. Thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure talking with you.
And I'm sure they don't have paper cups either. Sometimes, don't you know, the best way to tell a story is not head-on. We like a good sideways glance. What you see and hear in these unexpected glances can often teach you more about a place, person, or situation than any number of "So tell me what's going on here" interviews. That's a starting point for a segment we're starting on the show today called Sideways Glance, and The World's Clark Boyd kicks it off.
You don't get much more sideways than Belgium. When I was living there, a native put it this way. It's kind of like a little part of Holland the Dutch didn't want, a little part of France the French didn't want, and then a tiny sliver of Germany nobody wanted. Or, as this little video on Belgium puts it,
Belgium excels at making everything as complicated as possible.
a Dutch-speaking north, a French-speaking south, a linguistic and cultural clash with the multilingual mess called Brussels at the center of it all.
Brussels has like these layers, you know. On the ground level, it's a puzzle. On the human level, it is taped together. And then from the sky, there are hanging cables.
David Helbig moved from his native Germany to Brussels 11 years ago to pursue a career in the arts. He's always carried a camera with him on long walks, documenting the city's layers, its problems, and its unique, often absurd, solutions.
I started to see things other people wouldn't see immediately. So if I run around with my family, then I'm kind of the guide for Belgian solutions. I always say, like, look here, do you see this? Do you see this cable hanging out there? Isn't that weird? Or do you see how the whole city is taped together?
Belgian solutions. The idea stuck. Helbig started a Facebook page to share the photos. He was onto something. The page received more and more likes. People started submitting their own photos. And now, Helbig's got a new book out highlighting 300 of the finest Belgian solutions a person can find. So, what exactly is a Belgian solution? Ah, well.
A staircase which ends up at the wall, so into nothing. And I called this a solution because it was somehow not a failure, because somebody for sure just closed the door behind it or away. So it was once, it made sense. And now they thought, like, let's keep the staircase because people can still sit on it or something. So, like, I like this idea that this thing looks incredibly absurd, almost surreal. On the other hand, it makes also sense.
So, sensible absurdity. That's the combo you're looking for. Another of Helbig's favorites is a bike lane that goes right through the bars of a steel fence.
And you think, like, who was first? The guys who made the fence and thought, like, I don't give a damn. I mean, like, I was supposed to put a fence here, so I put my fence here. Or was it the bicycle, bike lane painters who thought, like, on my map it's written there should be a bike lane here, so I just make it.
Either way, both sides lost and also won.
Everything what is a bit funny in this country has also sometimes a little sad side.
Helbig's dead on there. Whenever I glimpsed a Belgian solution, it kind of became a metaphor for the jerry-rigged nature of the whole country. During the time I lived there, Belgium went for more than 500 days without a government. But Helbig doesn't necessarily see the metaphor as a negative one.
Somehow people are very conscious about that nothing is fixed and everything is changeable in the end. And that's, of course, incredibly inspiring for an artist or maybe also for politics. No, you can always think like, okay, this is not, we don't have to conserve the state of being. We just like, we are ready to change everything in a minute because everything is already quite open somehow.
Helbig says that so far, the Belgians are taking the cultural critique fairly well. But he does say, jokingly, that with his new book out, he might think about leaving Brussels for a while. When I interviewed him, the U.S. was in the throes of the financial crisis and government shutdown. I asked him if there were any Belgian solutions for that.
Why don't you just tape it? I mean, duct tape will solve it. Voilà.
Couldn't have said it better myself. For the world, I'm Clark Boyd.
Les Flamandes dansent sans rien dire au dimanche sonnant. Les Flamandes dansent sans rien dire. Les Flamandes, ça n'est pas causant. Si elles dansent, c'est parce qu'elles ont 20 ans. Et qu'à 20 ans, il faut se fiancer. Se fiancer pour pouvoir.
Music from Belgian crooner Jacques Brel takes us out today. You want to see some of those Belgian solutions? We've got a slideshow at PRI.org. You'll be left aghast. Aghast, I tell you, by the handicapped parking spot from hell. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. A bientôt and tot ziens.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.